because of the fact that tomorrow is a big celebration in the village because it's Frodo's and Bilbo's birthday, I thought we should stay with the imaginative expressions, the world of the imagination as seen by people like J.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, and later in the week, as an introduction to the language seminar we're going to have at the end of the week, Charles Williams. So that's simply a little introductory note to the lifestyle people, because they will be involved in a much more in-depth study of the life of the imagination than what you will get in these first two lectures. I am going to read a couple of quotes that I think are good from the point of view of trying to see how imagination and the image relate to each other, what it means to bring something forth in an imaginative way. I really like this quote from Midsummer Night's Dream by Shakespeare. You know, I'm sure most of you remember the story of Midsummer Night's Dream. It is an imaginative thing in the terms that we have always thought of the imagination. But these lines perhaps you don't remember. "And as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothings a local habitation and a name." The form of things unknown, the poet's pen gives to them these airy nothings. Now, airy, he doesn't mean, how do I know what he means? How does anybody know what Shakespeare means? We have to project our meanings into what Shakespeare meant. He didn't write a commentary. So all these well-noted and well-documented studies, you know, they are important, but I firmly believe in the participation of the reader in using his or her imagination in understanding what it is that any author writes, if he's so bold as to put it on paper. But I think airy nothings is, to me, means not that it's a superficial thing, but that it's something that we don't have in a concrete form. So it is invisible to us, and an airy nothing works as well as anything in a poetic, if someone is writing this kind of poetry. In fact, it doesn't work so well as anything. It works the best of anything for Shakespeare. This fitted the poetic mood of those lines, and it also said what he wanted it to say. So you and I can interpret it as we like. But airy nothings is not just a trivia. It's not just trivia that anybody you're just not saying anything very important. But this can be very important, but it has to be turned. These airy nothings have to have a local habitation and a name. Now, this is exactly what Lewis does, what George MacDonald does, and what Tolkien certainly does in the books and stories that they have written. They give to a name certain things that had no name before. They give a local habitation to these things that now have forms, that now are peopled, and they have a place to live. And those places in which those so-called airy nothings now live are extremely important, because they are exciting with the way in which real writers can describe and communicate the sense of place that these things occur. This is why Tolkien felt very strongly, for example, that the book, The Lord of the Rings, which is the three-volume long fairy tale that that many people up here have read, many of the young people, and not because they read it as children, because they were too old. And in fact, it's not really a book for little children to read. It's an adult fairy tale. It is for adults. And so when you talk about it, you talk about something that is a very real kind of kingdom for many of the staff people up here, and I'm sure many people on Lifestyle have read it, and some of the people that are older have dipped into it too. Tolkien felt that his book, for example, would not make a good film. He was very concerned about cinema or films. Really, what he said, they overturn the real meaning of the story, because so much of the charm and the enchantment of the fairy story comes in the reading of it, because you put a great deal of that into it yourself. And he said even illustrators tend to overdo and take the place of the kind of images that the person himself or herself would be building up and drawing out of his own mind if he but had the chance. The trouble is with the film and with TV, I don't like TV because after all I didn't have it when I was a child, so why should it be good? You know, the kind of feeling that anything that is that new can't be that good. But that's sort of the classical approach to education usually. But it isn't that, it's just that you feel that there's a stunting of the imagination. When TV has taken over, it supplies you with all the images. It's already taken care of everything that ordinarily you would have had to supply when you read the story. Because you would have had to do the illustrating yourself, you see, in your own mind. And you know yourself, when you think back on the stories you read. Now, I'm not talking to the younger people here right now, because you're too young. You grew up in a TV age, and you're going to have to fight it in order to conquer that kind of thing. And I think that's perhaps one reason why Holden has a peculiar appeal, because we don't have TV except in certain times and certain places when we can get some kind of TV reception. And it isn't that TV is, you know, per se bad, or that it you know, we don't ever look at it. Far be it from me to say that, but it does, there is something about a place in which it is not convenient to turn a button and have somebody else imagine everything for you or put forth everything in terms that are palatable for you. This is a place where you have to dig it out for yourself, or you're going to be mighty bored. And most people are not bored up here. And so I have a lot of faith in human beings that the qualities that the story writers assumed would be there are really there if they're just given a chance. And it's hard for those of us who live in ordinary society to keep the TV turned off. But I think you almost have to make it a discipline so that it doesn't dominate your life, and that you do allow certain times of your life to be devoted to some reading, or even to listening to the radio, because somehow when you look at things, it takes away a lot of the creative and discovery kinds of qualities of your own mind. So that's just as an introduction from the angle of the imagination, and that it must be a quality that you and I develop. And as I said at the close yesterday, that George MacDonald said it must be nourished all our lives. And by nourishing it, you do expose yourself sometimes to books that are imaginative, to books that fill your mind with some of those things that allow the imagination free play. sometimes if you go back to some of the stories that you read as a child or books that you knew, then that helps. That helps to bring back some of those image creating things. But there are a lot of things that have been written that you maybe didn't read, some of you, and I know some of you in lifestyle haven't read, such as Shakespeare and some of the stories in Chaucer and some of the old tales from your own ethnic backgrounds. Those of you who are Germans, some of the tales of the German myths or the sagas of the Scandinavians, that those have qualities of the imagination in them that somehow we haven't really explored. And we're very good at keeping up the tradition of the cooking, but we don't do much about the tradition of the story that is handed on from one generation to the next, so that in many respects they've stopped being told again and retold, and they're no longer a public memory for us as people. Some of the gifts that we have to give to our country in its bicentennial year are certainly in that area of recalling some of the stories that are part of our backgrounds. C.S. Lewis said that no book was really worth reading at the age of 10, which is not equally and often far more worth reading at the age of 50. Now that can cover everybody in this room. I don't think there's anybody under 10 here, and there are plenty of us that have reached 50 and gone beyond. So just think about the books that you read at the age of 10. If you can remember that far back. I had a hard time when I read that to try to remember what I was reading at the age of 10. It was such a mixed bag. But think about it. That means then that basically a children's story must be a very good story. And Lewis said that to write children's stories, so-called, was one of the most difficult things in the world to do. He did achieve it. He did achieve some very good stories in the Narnia series. And those of you who are not acquainted with them, they are in the both in our library and in the bookstore. And I almost would say it is a must for anybody who has any serious ideas about continuing a life of the Christian imagination, because there are not many books like that actually give to an invisible kind of thing as far as we're concerned. We've not ever actually seen some of the events, certainly, except as they parallel certain other people's living in a Christian way. But most of the events in the life of Jesus, or the way in which we understand his life to be should be lived, are not always that real to us. What is it that breaks through the rigidity of our lives so that we actually begin to feel again? Actually feel strong emotions about things that are important. And sometimes a story will do this in such a way that when we go back to even to reading the scriptures again or thinking about our lives as Christians, it comes with a new force and a fresh meaning, so that there's a new drive and energy to it. Because somehow the familiarity of all these things that we've heard for so long in our Christian church and in our own Christian lives, sometimes we just get bored with it, and we're afraid to admit it, and least of all to God, but certainly not to each other.
May we interrupt?
Yes.
I was considering the Narnia for our series for the church library, and I I didn't know enough about them. Now, if you had never read them as a child, you started to read, you could...
Goodness, read them as an adult. That's when I started.
Yeah.
I mean, most people didn't read them as a child because they were just written in the 50s. N-A-R-N-I-A, the Narnia series. And the series is written by a man who became a Christian later in life. And they're written with a great deal of sophistication, but not the kind of sophistication that we think of when we think of that word as a derogatory one sometimes. Sometimes it's a very good word, depends on how we feel, how inferior we feel. But they're written with sophistication. That is, they're written in a way that anybody can read them and project into them and not have to feel like he has to defend it later in life, because it really isn't quite true, you know. You have to kind of put some structures around it. They're written for entertainment, pure and simple, and all stories must be. They must be written not as propaganda, but as straight entertainment. And many people can read those stories and never take the underlying message of Christianity, which is in every one of the books. But it's not Sunday school stuff, you know. It doesn't come out like, you know, togetherness is when you go to church together or pray together or have family altar together or what have you. It does not come into that category. So it takes all of us, adults and children alike, by surprise. And this is extremely important, that we be surprised again. We're so dull and predictable that we don't expect anything to ever happen to us. And the imagination is the seat of where that surprise can take place.
Well, I don't want to sound like too much of a preacher, but I have a lot of elements of that in me, I realize.
When Lewis was referring to books for people that they should be just as good at the age of 10 as at the age of 50, he said, except, of course, books of information. The only imaginative works we ought to grow out of are those which it would have been better not to have read at all. And I have a horror of some of the books that are passed off as children's literature. I think they're abominable, terrible illustrations and stupid texts. But then, you know, I don't have young children, so I can't make too much of a shout about it, and I'm not writing anything better myself either, so that doesn't, you know. A mature palate will probably not much care for creme de menthe. Well, now that must have been something that was popular in Lewis's childhood. I don't think that's too popular with children now, but maybe spun sugar cones at the circus or something, maybe popsicles. But it still ought to enjoy bread and honey and peanut butter, I would say. I mean, you ought to still be able to enjoy the basic, there must be something basically good about those books that can still be enjoyed and delighted in, just as a good piece of bread and butter, especially when it's homemade, will taste to you no matter what age you are, as long as you can chew and taste it. Lewis, too, felt very strongly about the problem of the film, of the cinema, as they call it in Britain, over against the story. And he says, for example, the cinema should never replace popular fiction. And he was quite concerned that nobody should make a kind of a literary statement about, well, I don't know if that's the kind of popular writing you should read. You should read this. This would be much better for you. He says, really, you know, if people will read, if a younger person or an older person reads popular fiction, who knows what he's putting into that of his own imagination? Whereas if that kind of fiction is on film, he's putting nothing into it at all. It's all there for him to just simply absorb and maybe think about, but it hasn't really released any powers of his imagination to the extent which it would have been released had he read the story himself. The elements which it excludes are precisely those which give, for instance, an untrained mind its only access to the imaginative world. And he says something that I think is very true of the imagination, and probably will help us all to understand what it is about the imagination that is so different from other qualities in our mind. And that is that actually, if you can reread a story, this means that it really had qualities of a tremendous value to you. Now, why do you reread a story? You don't reread it because you don't know how it's going to end. In other words, the plot is taken care of. So obviously the plot was not the only thing that story had for you. What the story had for you was a quality of place again. It was the local habitation of these airy nothings that somehow created an element in you of identification, of excitement, of surprise, maybe of fear. And it was so important that it's worth rereading paragraphs out of that story or that book, although you know very well what's going to happen to the characters. Lewis says this is something that many writers forget when they're writing something, and they get so busy seeing to it that the plot is taken care of, that they forget that to build up the suspense in terms of descriptions and the ways in which the place smelled or felt, or the winds, the way they sounded, or the way in which the author describes that experience, these things are important to the element of story, which is going to call forth the most out of a person's imagination. This is the quality, I think, that is so evident it's evident in the Narnia books. I can't say how many times I've read those, and I know my children have read them many times. Goodness, I was worried for a while that one of them was reading, I thought he was reading this one Narnia book more often than he ever read the Bible, and I think it was true. But now he reads the Bible more than he reads the Narnia books. Now, which would you prefer? You prefer to have somebody never read the Bible, or just read it in a very sort of, well, this is what I have to read, and of course, I'm beyond this, but I got to please my family? Or would you rather have a youngster get really so excited about what really is going on in the scriptures that when he begins to tackle them again seriously, they really become the word of life to him? Now, I'm not saying that this is a bait. Don't give it to people as baits, but just give it to them as a chance to, find out what a surprise God might have in store for them. You don't have to tell them that God has got anything to do it, for heaven's sakes. And I literally mean for heaven's sakes, because the minute you tell them God is in it, they're going to really, most people really push it away. But I think that quality of rereading is a very, very good test of a good book, whether or not you can reread it. And I know myself that some books that were not all that good when I was young, I still think I could reread them now because of the way in which they built up certain feelings of coziness and warmth and enjoyment. And they were not profound books, but they had that quality in them. Time was taken to describe certain things. The smell of the way a cake was being baked and the way a poor family had to live and all these things. I remember books as simple as The Five Little Peppers that really, I still think of it with nostalgia because it was a way of life. Do you remember them?
I knew which one you meant when you said that.
right. Because they couldn't afford anything and you could, it was a great experience. If I could find them, I'd read them again.
I have a couple, three to four.
Have you? You might send me one and I'd send it back. But I'm not recommending them to other people as something to read. It's just that I don't think it, that the literature that really excites the imagination is always on the level of, you know, what we consider really great stuff, you know. Sometimes it isn't. And to try to make people feel depressed because, well, I don't really like to read all the stuff you like to read, so that they feel put down in their imaginations. I mean, what climate is there for them to grow if they feel judged already by the kind of thing that you say they should enjoy, or I say, well, you ought to like this, you know, because it's much better for you. Well, it's like telling somebody to like spinach if they don't like spinach, and they have to be sort of weaned into it with spinach souffle and spinach soup, and better that they don't see the spinach leaves, and, you know, that's the way the Narnia books do. No, they don't let you in on it. It's likewise with the Tolkien books. Also with Charles Williams, only in a different way. But these are ways in which the imagination can be used to develop a taste for something else, as well as and still retain a taste for the book that started them off on it. I'm going to spend most of the time this morning from now on Tolkien, because we are, as I say, celebrating this big birthday tomorrow, and some of you who have not, I don't know how many of the lifestyle people have read the Tolkien, the Fellowship of the Ring books, and I don't know how many of you people have read them who are down in the lower level here, but you don't have to read all the whole book, all three volumes in order to get a taste of it, but I would guess that if you can hold out, you'll find that each volume has a tremendous excitement and calling power as you read, and if you can stay with it and not feel that you have to turn on the TV or something else because it's a lot of words and I'm not used to reading that much. Start with the Narnia books. I think they're easier to much and much quicker. And some of the three volumes of C.S. Lewis's science fiction, which are extremely exciting, I think. Perelandra, the Out of the Silent Planet, Hideous Strength. All three of those are tremendously exciting. The Tolkien books, however, have a kind of a mythological character all of their own, and are exciting just as pure story. And most people, I think, would say that they have no particular Christian significance. They are interesting as stories. However, I will say that I read them one year when I was, I had never read them, and everybody else in my family had. I'm a stubborn person. I just sort of feel like, well, if something takes a long time, well, somebody else will have to start cleaning the house and making the food and doing all those things if I'm going to have time to read. Well, you know, that's a typical excuse that all women especially tend to make, but I find that we make them even after we're older when we don't have to do all those things. So you have to be careful of habits that they don't take over for you. But I broke my ankle and had an operation on it, so that I really had to stay off of it and stay practically prone most of the time. And I started reading The Fellowship of the Ring. And it was a very, very difficult time to read it, because I really got so scared while I was reading them, and I couldn't move much because I was on crutches. I didn't have a walking cast. And I'd read one book and I'd think, I'm not going to read anymore because I get too scared, and I'm not going to read when I have to stay up here all by myself. And the family would go off, you know, they'd go out to dinner or to a movie or someplace, and there I'd be, and the dog would be downstairs wailing and growling, and I'd be up there in that big house, and I couldn't get downstairs very fast, and what good would it do me if I did? And but believe me, those books created a tremendous fright.
Well, you say, I don't want to be frightened.
Well, it's not that kind of a fright, you know. It's a kind of a good kind of a fright. A really, really, you know, well, it's like when you read fairy tales. Didn't you like to read about the ogres and the trolls and things and, you know, and do those sort of shiver and shake because you knew it wasn't really true? Well, this is what these books do for you and why we think that this is something that is for little children. I don't know. But we've got that kind of a false myth really stuck in our brains. These are things that adults really, if you want, and I hate to put should in because then it gets to be such a judgmenty thing, but really adults can read these and profit by them because life is full of this kind of thing. And when you read a fairy tale of this nature and of this stature, it gives you a sense of the quest that all of our lives are on. Because the books of the Fellowship of the Ring are basically books of pilgrimage. They are about a hobbit who is an odd little creature to begin with, and you'll hear all about them tomorrow if you don't know about them, who has to go off on a strange, strange quest, and he's not capable, he's not able, he's just as unable as any of us, and somehow he has to go on this pilgrimage, just as you and I do, you know? It's really strange how much this idea of the quest is part of every fairy tale. Think of the fairy tales that you know, that you remember, and don't they almost all of them have some kind of a crazy mission that usually the youngest, homeliest, ugliest, most uncoordinated brother in the family had to go on, you know? And what kind of terrible people he met, and because he was so young and so dumb and so simple, he somehow did the right thing. You know, he would get help from somebody instead of thinking he was so smart he could get along without it. But these books have this quality. And, you know, I read these books during Lent. And never can I, as I remember, has it been so clear to me the kind of battle that there is between good and evil in our world. Never have I been so keenly aware of it as I was when I was reading these books and realized this is it. This the crucifixion isn't just a play acting, which sometimes we feel. And if you can't admit that, sometimes I think you need to ask yourselves, are you really being honest about your experiences in the church and in the faith? Sometimes we have to admit this and say, it's become so familiar, I no longer am excited about it. I no longer see how tremendous it is. And these books, somehow, it comes crashing in on you. That as Luther said, if we could look back on our lives after we're finished with them, we would see what a narrow path we were leading, with a huge ditch on one side and a huge gulf on another. And what protected us from falling in? Who knows? And that's what that's the kind of story that these books tell too. A story of a quest and a pilgrimage. But along the way, the habitation, the local place where all these things happen, are so real and so smelly and so you know, so audible. You can hear the wind whistling, and you know that the gray riders, the black riders, are coming over the hills, over the sunset. And these poor little guys that are on this trip have no place to hide. It's a bare hill, and where are they going to go to be out of the way of these? And then they hear these riders come past them. And you know, well, you say that's, you know, that's really imagination. Well, yes, of course it is. Let it be. Let it happen to you. I mean, you don't always have to live in the world of measurements and semaphores and how much gas is going to cost, sometimes we need to get outside of our time and look at it from the outside and get a new, fresh look at what happens to us in our daily living. And this is what Tolkien feels very strongly about in all fairy tales. And he talks about it in terms of four different things. And I think that the way he puts it is good, because you sense that these words are sometimes used as kind of in a derogatory manner over against this kind of reading or this kind of imagining. He talks about the fact that the world of fairy, of F-A-E with two dots over it, R-I-E, the world of fairy tales is a secondary world. Now, this is also the world of fiction in general, because you do have to have a willingness to suspend your disbelief. You have to have a willingness to not to say, but I'm not going to read that story, it isn't true. Well, I mean, if that's going to be what you always say, that it's not true to a certain kind of fact that you know, you're going to be pretty limited in what you read, because actually, a great deal of what you read in the newspapers is fiction, too. You better remember that you're suspending your disbelief when you read the reports in the newspapers, because they're not all factual either, and somehow we think that because it's in the newspaper, that's true, or in Time or Newsweek, or if it's said by Walter Cronkite, you know, the gospel according to Walter Cronkite is also a very important one for many people. I mean, it's possible that much as I enjoy him, he may make errors too. So your disbelief can be suspended in many directions. So you can't be quite so, you know, universal in criticism of that kind of thing when it comes to fiction and fairy tales. But he says that there is a kind of a secondary world that you live in when you move into the world of fairy tales or the world of fiction or the world of imagination. This is another kind of world. You have to say, no, this isn't, I'm not living in this particular spot right now. I'm living in a different spot. This is different. And, you know, the rules are different. The descriptions are different. Maybe even the air is different. Okay, so you live there. You allow that to happen to you. You can't just sit there and just say, this is crazy. Okay, it's crazy. You know, live in that world for a little while and be crazy. You'd be surprised how refreshing it is. Maybe you won't. I don't need to talk to you as if you don't know what I'm talking about, but I just assume that some people might not. Anyway, I will say this, that Tolkien is not without his tongue-in-cheek and sense of humor, because he said, after all, don't people who watch baseball games and football games, he didn't say that, he said cricket, but you know, we don't play cricket all that much in the United States, so I just put baseball and football. He said, aren't they creating a secondary world for themselves? Why do they get so excited about who's going to carry that ball? Is that real life? You know, you say, kill him, kill him. Do you really mean that? No, you listen. I mean, I don't know how many of you women do, but I've certainly heard plenty of men do, and I used to do it when I was young. Now I don't. Got more important things to kill. But they, you know, that is a secondary world, is it not? You've created your own world. A football game is a battle. Oh, how about you say they're not fighting with, you know, swords or anything terrible like that? Oh, yes, but you know what has happened to some of those men who've been injured in football? But that's a secondary world, and those rules, they're arbitrary rules. But we look at it and we accept them. These are the rules. Hey, you can't do that. That's not the rule. Completely we submit ourselves to that secondary world, And yet we think, oh, but I can't go into a world of the imagination like that. That would be wrong. Huh. Well, it's cheaper. Cheaper than going to a game, at least. It's not cheaper than looking at it on TV. But fairy stories do, if we allow ourselves to go into this secondary world, allow the rules of this world, the laws of this world to take over for us, can offer us four things, and I'm going to tell you about each one of them very quickly. One is the world of fantasy. Now, don't get a psychological understanding of that word and say, oh, you mean fantasize, because I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about fantasy as a kind of story. It's a story that is really not just not a novel, not like fiction, which simply tells a story about people who are like us, but in a little different circumstance. The world of fantasy takes a whole nother, entirely different kind of image. It takes beings that don't look like us, that don't act like us, that don't talk like us in quite the same way, although fortunately they use our language. Tolkien had, in the Fellowship of the Ring, had worked out a whole language called Elvish. And it's all, he's got a whole writing of it and a whole business. But he said he wished he could have written the whole thing in it, but he didn't know enough of the language yet. But anyway, the world of fantasy is this kind of world in which the beings are not, they don't dress like us, nor do they act exactly like us, although they have a lot of the same kind of emotions and responses that we do. Now, this is the kind of thing that adults especially, if they only will let themselves, can have a really maturing of the imagination in that respect, simply because an adult can form really good images of this nature with his or her imagination. A child may not be as able to do it, a little child, but an adult probably can, especially an adult who has maintained somewhat of a young attitude toward a life of wonder and surprise. And he is extremely concerned that grown-ups do keep on developing this quality in their imagination. And so he says, you know, reading books of fantasy would help us do this, because fantasy has two qualities that many of our lives do not have. One is the quality of wonder, and another of strangeness. We're most of the time so busy living in familiar surroundings and keeping ourselves, you know, from the sense of the wonder of the eternal that spreads about us. You know, I have real sense kind of almost fright sometimes when I stand beside on a seashore. It looks so endless to me. And sometimes you get that, I think some people get it on mountaintops. The feeling of awe and wonder and mystery about what is surrounding us. And Tolkien says this quality of wonder and amazement can also be had in a story, in a fantasy, because this is the way it's developed. Another angle that is always there is a kind of strangeness, a feeling that you really don't have things kind of neatly in a package, that life has a strangeness to it, that, well, Jesus is a strange physician himself. When you look at Jesus, for example, he's a strange one. I mean, we've domesticated him so that he doesn't seem strange to us, and you wonder sometimes, why did people like him? He's so nice. You know, we've really gotten a completely perverted idea of him, because we've tamed him down to fit our little pictures that make it convenient and comfortable to live with. But this quality of strangeness is in all of life. We don't understand it. It's a mystery. And this kind of thing is present in any good fantasy. A well-written one will have that quality. And then it has two in this quality of strangeness and mystery, it'll have a quality of enchantment. There'll be something about it that you can't put your finger on, but there is this feeling that something happens that you can't explain. And somebody has a kind of a way of getting something done that can't be outlined nor made into a formula. Now, this doesn't mean that that fantasy comes out of an unreasoned kind of mind, a person who doesn't want to think things through clearly. Usually fantasy is written, the best fantasy is written by people who have a great deal of intellectual content in their heads. If you think that fantasy is written by somebody who is just full of warm fuzzies, you have something else to deal with here. This is something that is written by people who have beaten out truths that are in the universe, that are deep in the mystery of being, and are able to put them out in a way in which they can be palatable and understandable to us. Not only do they have they thought through with a great deal of intellectual sweat and strength the truths of the universe, but they've also studied a great deal or read a lot about things that make for content in clothing these imaginary beings. So that, for instance, in Tolkien, much of his background is in the field of the saga, particularly the Icelandic and the Scandinavian sagas and the old stories of the Anglo-Saxons of Beowulf. In fact, he wrote one of the great monographs on Beowulf. And so you have these kind of strange dragon people in the background of his mind. But he has studied them. He's really read the folklore that have filled in the cauldron of story that bubbles up, as he says, to make all the folk tales that we've known for years and years and have just taken for granted that, of course, that's the way they're supposed to be. That's the way we've always heard it. And yet he's studied them so that when he writes his story, they have a consistency to them and a beauty and a weaving together of many, many strands that make them a delight to read. And they're not thin, just, you know, anybody's idea of something, but something that's very deep and profound in him. Besides fantasy, as far as it's being a world in which to live for a little while, he says that the meaning of living in those worlds of fantasy does imply that you need a recovery and an escape. In other words, that basically a person needs to get away from where he is in order to get a good perception of what his life is about. And this is what a fantasy tale does. It allows you, as I said before, to get outside of your time, of your place, of your apartment or your particular home or your particular family, and even get outside of time itself for a while and look at and live in another secondary world, so that when you come back, you're ready to talk about something else with a fresh and new way. And it's surprising, that's really what happens to you. Very often we think of escape literature as something that's kind of bad, it's kind of a, you know, it's a derogatory statement. But Tolkien says, he says about escape literature, "Why should a man be scorned if, finding himself in prison, he tries to get out and go home?" Well, you know, we'd say that's bad because, you know, why, you don't want people to escape from prisons. Well, think about it from the point of view of the person inside. Think about yourself as being in prison. We were in prison in the Philippines for 3 years, and we, if we could have thought of a way, and Carol did try to think of ways for us to escape and maybe get to a submarine, if we'd had any idea of any way we could do it, we would have. But he says, you know, would you scorn a person who tried to do something like that? From his point of view, he's inside. Or if, when he cannot do so, he thinks and talks about other topics than jailers and prison walls. Mm-hmm. And this is the what happens when you read escape literature, when you go off in the imagination. It fills your mind with another kind of conversation than just, you know, oh, I don't feel well today, or I really don't know if I should go to that doctor anymore, or I don't really can't stand my parents anymore, and if I have to live here another day, you know, I mean, I don't care what age you are, you've got some place where you're in prison, and you need to get out of it. And when you come back, you quit talking about that all the time. Then you slip back into it again, then you have to go into another, you sometimes have to take another escape route. And then he says that with the escape, with the need for recovery, you also need a renewal or consolation. And he said, this is what is true in almost all of fairy tales. And if you, what, how do most fairy tales end? Oh, they ended happily ever after. And that was really a mistake, of course, because we know that life doesn't end that way. Or does it? Does it end happily ever after? Well, I'm going to read the end of Tolkien's statement on this, because I think that it's a good way to close this particular session on Tolkien and the imagination and the need for our using some of our reading time to get into the world of fantasy. Because the world of the fairy tale has a great deal of the pilgrimage in it, the quest, the sense of wanting to find out or being sent out on some kind of a journey, which all of us are. We are on a journey, whether we know it or not, and we'd better be aware of it sometime. And then that sense that someplace there's an ending that's happy, that's good. And I know that, and you know, that this is not the Hollywood kind of happy ever after, that the prince and the princess, you know, and they always look like, used to, they don't anymore, but they used to look like glamour girls and glamour boys, and now when we look at them, they're horrible looking, but that was the way, you know, and they wore beautiful clothes and lived in beautiful houses and lived happily ever after, and you never heard about the divorces and the miseries that attended them, nor what was really happening to them in real life, those actors. But deep, deep in the fairy tale itself, this is not the Hollywood story, this is the real fairy tale, there is the ending that ends in real joy. And what he says is, at the end, this joy which I've selected as the mark of the true fairy tale or romance, or as the seal upon it, merits more consideration. Probably every writer of this kind of story really wants to make some kind of an ending that fits into that particular conclusion or climax. The peculiar quality of the joy in successful fantasy can thus be explained as a sudden glimpse of the underlying reality or truth. It is not only a consolation for the sorrow of this world, but a satisfaction and an answer to the question that most of us asked when we were children about any story, is it true? Is it true? The answer to this question that I gave at first was quite rightly, if you have built your little world well, this little secondary world that you've lived in fantasy, yes, it is true in that world. That is enough for the artist or the artist part of the artist. But in the you catastrophe, now, in the Greek prefix EU means good. And you know what a catastrophe is. It's something that happens that really bang like that. But can there be a you catastrophe, a good catastrophe? in the good catastrophe, in the you catastrophe, we see in a brief vision that the answer may be greater. It may be a far-off gleam or echo of evangelium, of the evangel, of the good news in the real world. The use of this word gives a hint of my epilogue. It is a serious and dangerous matter, this writing of a fairy tale. I am a Christian, and so at least should not be suspected of willful irreverence. Knowing my own ignorance and dullness, it is perhaps presumptuous of me to touch upon such a theme. But if by grace what I say has in any respect any validity, it is, of course, only one facet of a truth incalculably rich, finite only because the capacity of man for whom this was done is finite. And he says that he approaches the Christian story from this direction with a feeling, a joyous feeling, that God redeemed the corrupt making creatures, men, in a way fitting to this aspect as to others of their strange natures. The birth of Christ is the you catastrophe, the great good catastrophe of man's history. The resurrection is the you catastrophe, and for any of you who are writing this down, you catastrophe is spelled E-U, catastrophe, E-U. That's the, like Eucharist. The resurrection is the you catastrophe of the story of the incarnation. This story begins and ends in joy. It has preeminently the inner consistency of reality. There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits. For the art of it has a supremely convincing tone of primary art, that is, of creation. To reject this story leads only to sadness or wrath. It is not difficult to imagine the peculiar excitement and joy that one would feel if any specially beautiful fairy story were found to be primarily true, its narrative to be history without losing its wonderful qualities and significance mythically that it had possessed. It's not difficult for one is not called upon to try and conceive anything of a quality unknown. The joy would have the same quality, really. It looks forward or backward. The direction in this regard is unimportant. All fairy tales look forward to the great you catastrophe. The Christian joy, the Gloria, is of the same kind, but it is preeminently, infinitely, if our capacity were not finite, high and joyous, because this story is supreme, and it is true. Art has been verified. God is the Lord of angels and of men, and of elves. Legend and history have met and fused. In God's kingdom, the presence of the greatest does not depress the small. Redeemed man is still man. Story, fantasy still go on and should go on. Evangelium has not abrogated legends, it has hallowed them, especially the happy ending. The Christian has still to work with mind as well as body to suffer, hope, and die. But he may now perceive that all his bents and faculties have a purpose which can be redeemed. So great is the bounty with which he has been treated that he may now perhaps fairly dare to guess that in fantasy he may actually assist in the multiple enrichment of creation. All tales may come true, and yet at the last redeemed, they may be as like and as unlike. The forms that we give them as man, finally redeemed, will be like and unlike the fallen man that we know. I don't expect that you could have followed all that. It's hard to follow anything like that, you know, that's been read to you. But he does, Tolkien's book, a little book, Tree and Leaf, has this whole essay on fairy stories. And a book called Essays Presented to Charles Williams, in honor of him, but was published just after his death, because he died very suddenly, has this essay in it. It's a very long one, but parts of it I'm sure you would enjoy, and especially that last part, I almost think we should reprint at Holden for a little tract just to have around here. We couldn't publish it. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.